Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast, coming to you from the Axel Springer offices in Berlin. Very exciting. Yep, lots of smiles and nods. And let me introduce our very special guest who has welcomed us into the offices today, Alex Lund, Head of Programmatic with Upday. Hello, Alex.
Hello, hello. Thank you very much.
No, thank you. Thanks for having us. And, of course, we've got On The Road sound guy, Anne-Marie Sheedy, over there in the corner. Nod. Yeah, there we go. And so far the sound levels are okay?
Yeah,
good. Thumbs up.
Just been given a second chance. Because the first time in Germany wasn't
Didn't
a great
go
success.
So well. And of course, you can hear Lindsay Rowntree, Head of Content. And for your benefit, Alex, yes, we've done this before, as we mentioned to you on the Road podcast. And let's just say, yeah, the one recorded at Mexico is infamous.
It wasn't her fault.
No.
It was really, really. We're in the middle of a giant trade fair. Yeah. Not your fault at all.
No, there was a problem with the sound levels. It's all
She's
good.
She's looking very
today.
Mortified now. She's gone bright red.
Okay, let's move on to discussion of news stories. So I've gathered together a few news stories under a couple of themes for us to chat about this week. First one is under the theme of OTT and streaming slash, I suppose, streaming wars. A couple of news stories that came out last week, the first being that Sony are looking to shut down their PlayStation View service, which was their sort of streaming offer within, obviously, their gaming PlayStation hardware. And the second was Walmart reportedly looking to sell their video on demand service, which they bought 10 years ago, called Vudu. So we can probably talk about a lot of things connected to this. But my first thoughts were, this is coming sort of hot off the heels of Disney and Apple launching their own streaming services, their own TV streaming services, so that we know that there's a lot of competition out there in the market, particularly in the US. And it's begging the question, how are these players sort of looking to get into the market? And is it a case that they've set up their various offerings, whether that's a streaming service connected together with their hardware, or whether it's something they might have purchased, like Walmart's video on demand service? And have they just decided that actually there's no point in competing at this level because there's too many other players? Or is it a case of who's creating the content, and what is that costing them? Because we have lots of conversations, of course, about how these streaming services are going to be sustained over the longer term, since we know they rely largely on subscription revenue, as well as in some instances ad-funded revenue as well. So I guess just a general perspective to start with and point of view. Alex, what was your thoughts on these stories?
No, I think it's very interesting, and it's giving a lot of indicators about how these tech markets develop today, where it heavily relies on what is your user base, what is your point as a user in order to get access to these media platforms, being a news aggregator or being a streaming service. And then, of course, as you say, and as the articles also mentioned, how do you get content? So I think Upday had a brilliant move in partnering up with Samsung in order to get that user base that create the whole foundation for our product.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, making sure that they got the content for free to a certain extent from these thousands of publishers all over the world, where the Upday currency is more to bring user activity to these third-party publishers.
Yeah.
In exchange for getting content for free. And then it was kind of up to ourselves to figure out a model where we could either choose the subscription model or the free advertising model. And so far I have done an amazing job with the advertising model, which is so far working out pretty well.
Yeah. So it's interesting, really, isn't it, looking at the Upday example in comparison to these guys, because it strikes me, do you get into the streaming sort of world from the point of view of a content creator or the point of view of a sort of media platform, I suppose, that has user numbers? Lindsay, what's your point of view?
Yeah, I think exactly that. The when you look at the Upday model and the fact that you've started out with just kind of, you know, editorial news and news aggregation, it does make some logical sense to go down into the streaming road eventually. The Sony and Walmart kind of options are, you know, just because you can doesn't mean you should. And you wonder how they decided that actually, so Sony, we're in gaming. Actually, there are so many skinny bundles in the US now. We may as well be part of that. We've got a really loyal user base using our consoles all the time. It makes sense for them to kind of continue watching TV content on those consoles as well. I guess they thought that would be a great idea, but actually the people that come onto their platform to do gaming aren't necessarily then coming to watch TV on the platform as well. they're still going to like some Netflix, Amazon Prime, you know, Hulu, the kind of all the different other skinny bundles out there. And maybe they didn't think of Sony as being
an option.
Yeah, exactly. Being the thing that the right place for them. And Walmart as well. I don't know if Walmart was going to become kind of the next modern day blockbuster, but again, it just didn't make sense. And it makes there's far greater things for Walmart to be focusing on than trying to be the next company that owns a big streaming service.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's other companies out there that can do it better because they have the resource. And Update is a great example of that. They have the resource, they have the baseline, they have the audience that realistically you would believe would, well, if I'm already reading my news on your service, I probably will come to you for streaming video as well. It makes a lot more sense to me, logically, just from a consumer perspective.
And Alex, what is your perspective on this within the German marketplace, which is that we're often talking about whether the degree to which people have got subscription fatigue, right? So you can have a number of subscriptions on, you know, sort of under your belt for a variety of things, including content, TV content. At what point do you decide, actually, that's enough? You know, I'm not gonna subscribe to, you know, 5 or 6 streaming services. I'm actually going to try to reduce those, or I'm going to be looking elsewhere to add funded content so that I can consume that content for free. Is that something that's talked about widely in the marketplace here in Germany? Because I know it's something that's talked about quite widely in the US and the UK.
I mean, I guess it comes down to the individual publisher, what they allow and what they don't allow. So we even have some publishers which still requires you to have a subscription to that particular news outlet if you want to see that particular article. Other publishers and other partnerships give more premium content for free. So that very much varies depending on how they integrated with us. It's important for Update to be this very free news aggregator, so we don't push certain content on the user. We have journalists and editors who selectively choose the stories of the day, update them 2-3 times a week, and then an AI in the back that choose the articles that you say is most interesting to you as a user based on your pre-selected interest and what you actually click on, what you read, how long time you spend there. So it varies a lot. But I heard from some of the publishers we integrate with that there's a whole market on can you get users from Update. So they try to optimize their article and how they push the article to Update in order to get more traction from our platform. And in that sense, you have a whole nother element of the platform, which I think was not intended to begin with, but becomes a very interesting part of how you cooperate with your different publishers.
Yeah, because I could understand how that would be important for them, right? Because obviously they're getting something from your platform, but it's also quite critical to them to understand what of their sort of, you know, news production and content production is being most consumed. So they want to understand those users as much as you're able to understand them, I suppose.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I guess as with any other digital product today, it's all about optimization. So once you have the connection established, you have to take the next move to say, how can we get even more out of this connection and more and more and more? I know it from ourselves. This is how we do it. So obviously, having these different channels and a network of digital products around on the web obviously requires that people also automatically results in these different news publishers also optimize towards that.
And from a streaming wars perspective, Lindsay, where is this going to go? I mean, you know, we talk about it quite a lot in terms of the US being much more of a fragmented and crowded marketplace than European marketplaces. But what's your point of view in terms of, I suppose, media platforms or media services, content providers? Are we going to start to see a division between the two? Are we going to start to see that those that have got the big budgets for content production are going to be sticking to content production, and those media businesses that have got the users and the eyeballs are going to be sticking to the sort of platform ownership?
I do think it's an interesting one. I think particularly if you look, a lot of this is being led out of the US, but at the same time, Europe has its own nuances and it has many independent companies that aren't being run from the US. So companies outside of the likes of Netflix and Amazon, which everyone thinks dominates every market, but that isn't necessarily the case. But I think that we'll continue seeing more and more consolidation. And we'll continue seeing kind of the companies that haven't set out to do this first and foremost, probably having to pull away because they realize they just can't compete with the likes of Netflix, Amazon. You've got now got Disney Plus. There's so much consolidation happening in the US market, and those platforms are now entering Europe as well, or will soon be entering Europe. You know, I turned my phone on the other day. I've got an iPhone, obviously, a Fisher Price phone, as some people call it in our company.
A lot of Samsung phones here in the Upday office.
Well, absolutely. I'm sorry to be in the Upday office with an iPhone. I do apologise. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I've now got the Apple Plus, TV Plus app on my phone, and I was having a play around with it. It's pretty cool, actually. I quite like it. But that's another thing that I've got to get used to. I'm already subscribing to Netflix and Amazon Prime. Will I use this? Actually, I won't. Frankly,
unless there's something on there that you really want to see,
yeah.
Right?
But then I have to pay for a subscription for it, but I have to buy it outright. Mm. Like, it's all very. I'm not sure. I'm not. There are people that obviously flit around from place to place, especially in the US, where there are so many different types of models and these little skinny bundles that they refer to, where you can get four channels here for $10, another five channels there for $11. You end up paying God knows how much per month anyway. Obviously, we talk about this quite a lot, but in Europe, it's still slightly different, and there is still more loyalty. And there's also there's not the same like animosity towards cable TV. Like in Germany, cable TV is still very common. In the US, it's really, really expensive. In the UK, there's still Sky, and obviously Sky have launched Now TV, so there's kind of popularity there as well. And they've worked out, you know, who their market is, where the market's going, and tried to create something to cater towards a different market that wouldn't necessarily be an outright Sky box customer. But I think in terms of streaming wars in general, we are going to start to see the bigger players win out, and you'll start to really see who can win in this market. And does that mean a division of traditional content and video content? Maybe. Or is it the traditional content players that can win in what video and streaming will become? I don't know. It's interesting.
I think you're also touching point with a very interesting element right there, which is can you develop an original product based on a non-subscription model, on these free freemiums? And I think it's very challenging. I know in the whole media world, news especially, a lot of people don't believe it. They believe in the traditional stories, and you can also see, obviously, the revenue per user is higher
exactly.
when it comes to it. But maybe it gives you more freedom if you don't have that interest as a stakeholder. If we're Google, or if we're not Google and we're not CNN, and we're this news aggregator who tries to be fair to everybody, both user and publisher, then maybe that gives us an advantage where no one sees, okay, we actually promote different elements or manipulate with the business model in order to reach certain goals.
Because you aren't trying to push one agenda. You're trying to be the platform out there for everybody, the everyman platform.
Exactly.
That is Upday. That's your new strap line. I've just created it for you.
Thank you. I'll bring it on.
You'll get it for free. I won't charge you this time. Yeah.
And what do you think in terms of streaming wars, what's going to stand out here in the German marketplace? Are you going to see international players do well here, or do you think it's going to be a case of more local solutions tailored to the market sort of dominating?
I can tell you one of the biggest news aggregators on the radar right now is Google. So there's definitely an international actor coming in. I think it's probably, as of now, Upday pride ourselves of being international. We have all of Europe. We want to expand further. We have other countries on the agenda. And it requires you to be international if you want to be this successful news aggregator. Mm. Because otherwise you already have those hard established media houses around in each individual country. So what is a well-established Danish news media agency going to do in Germany, and vice versa? They don't know, unless they're going to cover it in a different manner.
Yeah.
But I think Axel Springer have found a very interesting way to cooperate with a lot of different media agencies all over the world in order to get that international spark. But you need to have that momentum in order to create a certain level of disruption in the market.
Yeah, it's interesting to think, actually, you know, with the Upday product and the way that Axel Springer are organizing themselves, obviously just recently taken on investment from the American investment.
KKR.
Yes, that's it. Thank you.
American
investment. I knew there was a K, and I knew there was an R.
How many?
Yeah. KKR. It's interesting to just wonder where that, you know, where the Axel Springer business is going to go, actually. You know, could it become an international media house, a truly international media house that's...
like News Corp type.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, that is, as far as I know, I'm not...
You're not in the decision-making board meetings on that every day, Alex? Not yet.
You work in the startup part of this giant, exactly. giant office, which is like a city in itself.
Yes, we can verify, listeners. Massive office. But you do have...
really lost.
But you do have a ping pong table here, so it's definitely startup territory.
Definitely, right? And a foosball and something on the walls.
Yeah, yeah. Leg chair.
But no, as I strongly have a feeling that's the mission of Axel Springer, being as news media, or being as classified. It definitely seems that the international role is something they want to take on. And I strongly believe that Update is a flagship in that direction, both in terms of cooperation from the content side, but also from the monetization side. Now you suddenly operate with partners, international partners, rather than just these traditional German partners or UK or whatever it might be. So it opens up a lot of new strategic partnership building as well.
It's really interesting. Let's return to some of that in a bit more detail later on in the podcast. I want to move on to the second story that I wanted to chat with the two of you about, which is a direct-to-consumer story coming from a company called Stitch Fix, who are a subscription service for clothes and fashion delivery. The idea being that you set up a profile, you go through a whole stage of determining the types of, you know, your personal style, the things that you like to wear, the things you don't like to wear, and they send you a bunch of clothes. You decide whether you like them and want to keep them and pay for them, or if not, you give them back. Now, because of the sort of customized, tailored approach that they're adopting, they're talking a lot in the media lately about how they're using their own first-party customer data to then design customized algorithms to target their users with things they're likely to be more interested in, things that they're likely to buy. So they're making money, they're monetizing the service off the back of a sort of a fee, if you like, a membership or subscription fee, and then of course selling the clothes and accessories beyond that. So they've got a real interest in working out what people are more likely to buy. I thought this was an interesting story because it talks about how it's a potential sort of like-for-like competition with the notion of Amazon and other online marketplaces, who of course use their own first-party data to continually retarget customers with things that they think they might like. And this is really interesting because Stitch Fix, very difficult to pronounce.
Yeah.
quite difficult to pronounce, particularly if you're trying to get it out quickly. it's interesting because they're doing this in-house. Really interesting story. Alex, what was your point of view on this story?
I think it's super interesting. I mean, today data is the essence of your company. And whatever idea, digital idea or hardware idea even you come up with today, if you cannot pivot it towards how you manage your data and how you leverage on that element, then you're more or less doomed to fail. You need to leverage on that. And in updates, interesting on multiple aspects. First of all, obviously we need users to use our app more and more, like every app needs to do today. This can only happen with understanding the data. For instance, how do we direct articles with them? The more interesting we make our content towards this particular user, the more they swipe, the more they're interested in using it, the more they click and the more they come back as a retention, and even get new users on board as well. This data insights we also have in terms of each individual ad placement in the app, so we can see how are these individual apps performing in terms of viewability, in terms of price, how do we sell them? And optimize our prices and our offers towards that to external partners. And this data stream in the end is also used for how do we then optimize these partnerships to pivot both from a sales point of view, saying based on these data insights and have on your deal, we can take a turn on it. We can either add something or we can change some certain elements in order to improve their KPIs, which then will improve our KPIs. Or we can establish these mass algorithms that take all the data into account in order to automatically update certain pricing rules towards some of our main open marketplace partners. so we don't need to manually change this, but have data engineering in place for this to automate automatically. And that's, data. But in three completely separate elements, that is, of course, completely intertangled.
And I guess the thing that is unifying about all of that data activity is that it is trying to hone in as closely as you possibly can to each individual user and what they do, what they consume, what they're more likely to interact with, how they're interacting with the app, what level of activity they kind of undertake when they're in the app, what they're looking at, what they're not looking at.
Exactly. So the value for them, which is also the value for us in the end, so the value and the value for our partners.
Yeah.
So it's the value for all three that needs to increase in symbiosis. If you just increase it for one, doesn't necessarily increase it for the others, unless you keep an eye on all three of them.
Yeah. What do you think, Lindsay? Do you think Stitch Fix are, doing some pretty interesting data crunching to kind of become the sort of aggregation site of potential fashion items?
I do. I think it's really interesting. As Alex said, it's all about data. And one of the challenges that you have with anything like this is trying to maintain, get customer loyalty and get retention and get repeat business. And this is a great way of Stitch Fix trying to do that. As we've spoken to many DTCs over the past sort of year or so, and obviously data is fundamentally important to them and their business and growing their business, acquiring new customers and maintaining customers. But as you grow, how do you keep doing the same, be able to do the same level of data research you would do and be able to kind of have the same kind of close relationship with each individual customer that you would do when you're on a smaller scale? You have to be able to try and do that at scale. And the only way to do that is to try to actually make your data smarter than it already is. So actually know what data you have in front of you and do what you can to spit out this latency style map, whatever it is they're calling, which if you go onto the Forbes website, there's an example of it there. It's actually pretty cool. Not that you can get on a phone though, I just tried. It's stupid. So might want to think about that, Forbes, just FYI. But it's fascinating because they will have been doing this anyway from a certain perspective on a smaller scale. Then how do they recreate that with the many thousands of customers they have now? They can't do it manually. They need data crunching. They need AI to be able to. Exactly. Yeah. So I think it's fascinating. I think a lot of other DTCs will look to this to understand how they can do something similar, because they're all trying to look at what is that next stage of growth for me. And that next stage of growth does require me being able to do something really smart with my data, but I don't know what that looks like yet. And this has obviously taken them a long time, and they've had struggles, and I think Wall Street have got very close on them at the moment. So them being able to do this could actually be the next thing that will take them to the next stage of growth. And other DTCs will be looking very closely at that.
We can imagine if they are successful with this, because you're talking about a DTC brand that's got a range of products, so it's all sorts of all manner of clothing items. And I guess the question becomes, how do you achieve more growth in that environment? Because it's not necessarily a brand play. It's more a sort of convenience factor. So how do you get to the next level of growth, and how do you use your customer data to do that? Like you say, it's all about automation. And I had a bit of a nose around on the site and signed up because I thought, let's just see what this is like. So I'll report back in a future podcast.
Oh, thank you.
After my first delivery. But it's really interesting because it gets you quite engaged in what's going on in the site, and you find yourself swiping through sort of potential items, not because you're shopping or selecting them, but because they're asking questions about whether it's the sort of thing you would be interested in. Is this the kind of thing that you would wear? And it occurred to me, it is a bit similar to interacting with something like an information aggregation site, because
that's
you scroll
so true,
through
actually.
Going, that article's interesting, that's not, oh, that's interesting. And it sort of coaxes you into making some choices and some selections while you're actually on the site. And obviously they're using all of that activity to then refine the ways in which they're interacting with you. It's actually very clever. And if they manage to achieve some success through this, you could imagine other DTC brands that have got a range of products doing the same thing, because I suppose similarly, that's a little bit what content aggregation is like. It's like a range of content pieces that you need to tailor to your audience and work out.
Yeah, and it's beautiful if you can use all those insights, or let's say they finish building that algorithm, so they don't need X amount of employees to actually select other clothing,
manually.
And also
in order for
have the products running around, and people don't return 10 out of 10 but keep some of it as well. And once you get those insights, the key is to then apply it to other products, other areas, which I guess is the beauty you see in the tech giants today. They know exactly how to do this.
Yeah, and exactly. It will allow them to increase their pool of inventory as well. If we're able to chuck all this inventory in and it spits out a recommendation for an individual customer, that means we can put in more into it in the first place, which I guess the same applies to kind of any kind of aggregation engine, really. If we're able to automate the process, we can put even more into it in the first place and then give an even more customized, stylized approach. That's the wrong word. I can't try and think what I'm trying to say. Long morning.
I've just come off a flight.
I know, it's exactly. Okay. But yeah. a stylized recommendation engine for each individual consumer. And yep. That's really smart and powerful.
And you know, what's interesting about this as well is that I can remember in the early days of Spotify, and in the early days of consuming digital music, I was feeling, and this will be giving away my age, I was feeling a bit sad about the notion of not kind of browsing around a record store anymore. Like the idea that I just used to, and that's what I used to do when I was a teenager, is go the record store and flip through, you know, racks and racks and racks of records and one, you know, and maybe listen to a few things and then take them away. And I was thinking, oh, there's nothing similar to that in a digital context. But actually, I'm completely in love with the way that Spotify recommends music to me, because it's almost like discovering it by listening to a DJ or a radio station that might be interesting to you. And it strikes me that this is a similar sort of thing with content aggregation and content consuming, and they're applying it to a product consumption in a product consumption context. It's actually really clever, and it means that it could also change the way that people shop. I'm using air quotes here, because when you're on the site, you don't actually feel like you're shopping. You're just answering a bunch of questions and you're talking a bit about your lifestyle, and then the next thing you know, in theory anyway, you get a parcel and it might have some interesting things in there that you want to buy. We'll see. I'll tell you what happens at the next stage.
Well, there's another one. What's the one that sells all the shoes? Another DTC, but I can't think of the name of it, but they do a lot of advertising on TV, and it's
not
women with
birds,
14 million shoes. It's different styles of shoes. They're not like...
Okay, not a branded
but
shoe.
But they do something similar. So you go onto the site and it says, do you like these shoes? Like, do you wear these boots? Do you wear these trainers? And then they come back to you with a recommendation of things you can buy on a monthly basis. So I think it's a good way for them to go to really understand their consumers really quickly, actually, because you can get a really good idea of what your consumer likes and dislikes from a few questions, and you can then update those questions. If when you get new inventory in, you can re-ask the same questions a few months later, keep it updated, keep it regular. It's a great way of being able to iterate on new products and really understand how your consumer evolves and how you as a business evolve.
And in the end, provide a whole new service, right?
Exactly.
Not only can you do it for free, but you can also actually have an interest in sending it to your doorstep free of charge and take it back again free of charge, because it's interest to them to get those data insights.
Yeah. Exactly.
And that's where we end up using our personal data as a sort of currency to get this extra service.
And in that context, I'm totally comfortable with that, because I want someone to make some stuff for me easier. I'm very happy with that. I'm happy to give over my personal data if you can kind of solve these, again, air quotes, problems for me, which is I don't have time to go shopping and now and then I need to update my wardrobe. If you can sort that out for me, that would be great. And that is where I think perhaps as consumers we're going to start moving towards. That's the journey that we're taking. I know we're going to talk about this a lot tomorrow at ATS Berlin. There's all sorts of data privacy issues obviously around the way that people use and trade their data, but particularly from a publishing perspective as well, it's really important for people to understand why there is a value exchange there. It's not just people mining your personal data for no purpose or point whatsoever. There is a value exchange involved in this.
That's
you must find yourself thinking about that a lot.
Yeah, certainly. And I'm in the same boat as you. It definitely makes sense, because you get so much out of it. And at the end of the day, your data in itself is not worth a lot, to say anything at all. It's the mass data of the whole thing that makes sense.
You're saying that each individual is worthless. Your data is worth nothing, I'm afraid. You alone don't mean anything to any of us. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
Welcome to the modern age.
I think that was incorrectly paraphrased there. Yeah, 1984, totally.
We're all there. Unfortunately, that's the reality of the whole thing. That you cannot, as a Google would not be for you if you were the only one using Google, as then it would not exist. And so on with all the social media outlets and whatever products you have today, as most digital products, I assume. That is the currency. But I think today we also get that next wave of being, it's more transparency in this currency, more exchange. Now it moves out of being in the hands of each individual company to be more to the consumer, controlled by the consumer, which is something I've been longing for a long time. but you don't really have the tools available. And the technology takes time. I mean, these tech giants just move in such a rapid pace, so we will always be a little bit behind in terms of regulation and insights for that matter. So right now we know what we get, but we're not entirely sure about how much do we give.
Yeah, yeah, good point. That's a really good way to phrase it. Okay, well, moving into the third news story, which is absolutely in your wheelhouse here, Alex, I'm sure you're going to have lots to say, which is under the umbrella of publisher business strategies and monetization strategies. Two things that I've been wanting to talk about. One is a story from a couple of weeks ago that for one reason and another we haven't had a chance to talk about on the podcast, which is that the Huffington Post is reportedly up for sale. Really interesting. You know, strong digital audience, you know, interesting business model. It's hotly tipped that their you know, ad-funded revenue is declining, and that's one of the reasons why they're putting themselves up for sale. And the second is that CNN is preparing to launch an online news aggregator, and specifically, I suppose, particularly in a US context, to compete with tech giants who've got very popular existing news aggregation sites, and we presume offering an alternative perhaps for both publishers and users. I'm going to start with Lindsay on this and then swing back to you, Alex. What's your point of view on these stories, Lindsay?
Put me on the spot. Thank you very much.
Thought you might have time to quickly read the article.
Yeah, but no, I haven't had done that. No, I couldn't speed read that fast. Thank you. Thank you, though. I mean, no, I think this is fascinating. I mean, Huffington Post, it was reported by TechCrunch, which the irony is not lost on me, obviously another Verizon property. But it's fascinating. It's, you would think of it as a massive shame because Huffington Post is a very, very well-known publication. You'd be surprised that it's actually not meeting revenue targets. You would think that it was
set up as an alternative to other news outlets and had a very popular following, particularly in the early days.
Exactly. So what is it doing wrong from a monetization perspective? Is it that just people aren't interested in targeting anymore? You would think it would have a really relevant audience. So it's not that, can it just not, where's the fill gone? Kind of, what are they trying to monetize? What's their approach there, and why does Verizon believe that they can't make this publication work anymore? I find it fascinating. And then obviously CNN launching a news aggregator. We talked about Facebook News on the podcast last week with Tanzil and Mark from Double Verify, and I think there's so much going on, and this is highly relevant to Update as well. Another news aggregator, I guess it's another option for more choice, or is it that we're now getting too many news aggregators that are all, you know, trying to give you, as an aggregator, you know, I could have one particular viewpoint in the news. How many aggregators would I go to or use to get my fill of news every day? And is CNN kind of my sort of business finance go-to? Is like Apple News where I go to read all the gossip because it understands that I read this kind of article? Is Update then where I go to for all my sort of sports news? Like, how are they defining themselves? Kind of what
as
is
an offering?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And how are they understanding each of their users? And if you put in the same information into each one, what kind of news would keep coming back at you? How are they trying to unpick you as a consumer? I do find it interesting. But CNN, again, another opportunity to go against the likes of Google and now likes of Facebook as well, because they believe that they are not offering what publishers need. Google certainly not. We've got the European Copyright Directive happening at the moment in, you know, particularly in France, where Google's refusing to pay publishers for basically using excerpts of their
content
on Google News. Yeah. Facebook has now gone, we believe publishers are very, very valuable. We will pay them for their news. So there's that kind of argument going on. How, as another new news aggregator, how will CNN be monetizing and reimbursing the publishers it works with? There's loads to unpick, I think.
And I think that's another point, and so I'd be interested in your point of view here, Alex, too, is that I think that the article had also said, you know, CNN certainly by means of trying to promote their news aggregation site, we're talking about how they feel their news discovery sort of algorithms are going to be significantly different to those of the incumbents. So different to Google, perhaps different to Facebook and other social media platforms. I'm not sure how different they will be to Apple News and others. But it strikes me that there is something in this, not just about the relationship that they're having with publishers and advertisers, which is critically important, but also how they're enabling users to discover the news that they post on their site. Because like you said, Lindsay, we've recognised some of these global international brands for a particular brand of news, for a particular type of news. So is it that people would go to them on the basis of that, or is it that they're that whatever algorithms they're using to surface relevant stories and relevant content is the thing that will drive them to the site? Alex, you'll have so much to say about this.
Yeah, I mean, obviously competition is always good, especially coming from a pure liberal mindset. But I would also say, as far as I understood the CNN move, it's in order to to face that challenge that in any case they buy so much traffic from Facebook and Google in terms of getting users to their platform. So why not try to create that platform themselves
within their own properties?
Within their own properties, but then it's, as you say, it comes down to the technology, or it comes down to how do you market yourself towards other news aggregation or media outlets. So it's going to be definitely a more saturated market, but I also think it could be a response from Google in terms of saying, okay, they see more and more people coming up, more and more technologies coming up in this field, so they need to do something. I know they did the same thing with the job classifieds, so with job posts and so on. They also suddenly, you had Google coming up because they had all the first party data in order to make this much more efficient. So I think they will come in, hopefully, with a new standard for the technology that people need to adhere to. And then it's either going to develop on the technology side or try to market yourself, if that makes sense for you.
Yes, I see what you mean.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I think they have to survive. Like, if they're going against, they don't want to keep relying on the likes of Facebook to get their traffic and then to help them monetize. Facebook is very much better than ever, you know, for many publishers, that they know they have to rely on them. They hate relying on them, but they know they have to. And there are some, I said this last week as well, there are some digital publishers out there that have built a business off the back of Facebook and Facebook alone, and they would never kind of come off that platform. CNN need to really understand, you know, can they genuinely compete with Facebook in this? Are they big enough? Do they have a wide enough user base? Do they have a technology, Alex, to your point as well? Do they know what they're building, and will they be able to build what they need to actually genuinely compete against the likes of Google and Facebook? I don't know at the moment. I don't really see it.
And that's what's
seem confident. So,
and this is what's interesting, right? Is that we'll start to see whether, I suppose, how much of Google and Facebook's offerings are so broad-reaching and wide-scale that it makes it very difficult, near impossible, for others to compete with them, or how much of their offering just also isn't perhaps relevant. Perhaps, you know, CNN will be able to pick up a ton of users because people don't want to consume their news content on those other platforms.
Yeah, I think it's a very valid point there. There's a big difference from coming from the companies, Google, Facebook, whoever, who's a data-first, technology-first company, and most of all, freemium. Everything has to be free. Yeah. Then you figure out how to make a buck on it. Where CNN is completely different, and that's the whole problem with a lot of news media. It's a subscription first, it's money first. Things need to be at least some zero, otherwise this probably doesn't make a lot of sense. And then switch over to this freemium model, based on data, which is suddenly they need to collect data, manage data, engineer the whole data in terms of creating this engine. And then you can argue that they may have a disadvantage towards who they want to compete with.
Yeah, but it is interesting, right? So, you know, I suppose we can say from Update's point of view that actually you're coming from a content perspective first, building the content out. I suppose that's what's also, I'm already branching into second part of the podcast territory here, but it would be good, Alex, if you can say a little bit about Update's model, because I think one of the other unique things about you guys is that you put a lot of investment and effort into content production as well. So you have writers and journalists, you know, you are structuring your offerings from that content first perspective, and then applying the technology over the top and using your user data in order to make that relevant.
Exactly. So fundamentally, we have the product content split in two. On one hand, we have the editors and journalists who make sure all our users are up to date with today's news all over the world, or at least in each individual country where we're represented in Europe. And that's what attracts most of our users. They create the push notifications, they make sure that you are informed. Then comes the AI that kicks in, which is another section of the app, and that based on your pre-selected interest groups, being 16 different categories with subcategories, you can keep modifying in those selection criteria you have. And it will move on to analyze how are you using this news stream. What are you clicking on? How long time do you spend on reading through the news headers or the subjects? It's called resumes, news resumes. What do you like, dislike? And then try to optimize based on an AI that then takes your behavior into account. So yeah, that's definitely how we try to create the retention, by mixing those two things together. And monetization wise, there's also a big difference on how do you show advertisement here, because it all relates to how are the user using the app. Are they using mostly where the journalists are selecting the articles, or is it more based on our AI? And then our pricing then goes towards how people are swiping through, how much time they spend on each individual advertisement card, how they click, and how much reach these particular things have.
Quite a sophisticated offering, then, it strikes me.
It becomes very sophisticated, where you will have specific price rules based on ad placement and country, and then it will vary depending on each partner and how this partner is integrated with. So in the foundation or the backbone, we have the open marketplace, which is some of the bigger partners in the digital advertisement space, who have different prices that give them a certain cost, or what's called a waterfall setup. This is slowly switching over to a first price auction, which provide a higher price, more bids, more competition in the programmatic space, and less pre-selection from publisher side. And on top of that, we will then have the private auctions, preferred deals, and more traditional IO basis agreements. And what we do is, at one hand, create a lot of transparency in our prices, depending on if you want to pay this, you can get that. If you want to get that, you have to pay this. So we kind of take a transparent model in terms of offering as much different as possible, without confusing our clients, of course. And then mix it together so we have a full competition, a full free market on how you buy advertisement spend. But if you want that guaranteed element and you're willing to pay the price, obviously you get, when you say, selected or prioritized higher up in this whole mediation stack.
And how have you found that publishers have received the offerings as they've become perhaps a bit more sophisticated over time? What is your, big smiles?
In the beginning, I thought, this is brilliant. Now I can see all the data. It all makes sense. As long as they find something that attracts them, then they want to buy something. And I would say the majority of responses was, it's a little confusing, this. I just want run of sight. I just want what the other guys are offering me, say, if you pay $4, you just have your advertisement on my website. Yeah. So instead of letting them do that calculation, it was more important to take all that transparency and use internally, and then we act as the consultant for them, being, what do you want? What do you actually want with your advertisement space? Do you just want impression for a cheap price? You don't care about clicks? Okay, then we can do that. And then we offer these elements or these placements. Do you want more, what can I say, high visible placements with a lot of high click-through rates, then the price is obviously higher, but then we orient, then we focus on those packages and deals that offer that. So instead of just giving them a big price list with each country as a booklet about what you can do, it's more important that we actually consult them through the whole process, get them up and running on a deal that responds to them, and continuously optimize towards saying, okay, now you get the higher prices, you see magnificent performance, you reach your budgets and everything. Now let's try to move towards a cheaper deal in parallel, so you can minimize your spending but increase your volumes, and then slowly see how can we improve their KPIs and ultimately get them to spend more within our app, or vice versa, having them at low volumes and then slowly build up towards the other type of deals. So actively operating with all these different offers that are available in the programmatic space.
And so how have, there must be, publishers must have some sort of stories to tell about how things have gone for them since they've been working with you. Have they seen some real increases in yield as a result of kind of maybe trying some slightly different things, working together with you on a bit more of a consultative basis to work out what they should be spending and where?
Yeah, we have a very interesting retargeting partner who started with just, a private auction at a floor price, and then they would just try to win as many impressions as possible. we then switch it over to say, instead of just having one impression at a very low floor price, maybe we just create, let's say, 15, 20 different private auctions with various targeting at different prices, which sort of replicate a header bidding system, but within an ad server space. And it actually turned out that we could increase the CTR four times, going from 0.5 to 2-3%, and even higher, because we made maximum use of all these different opportunities we had ahead.
It sounds like they're very, we'll work with you, but we want to work with you on our terms. And then you have to go in, and you talked about, you know, being very consultative. It's obviously a massive education piece for both the publisher and the advertiser that are probably also used to going, having direct relationships too. Like, why would we go via the Update in this scenario? Has it helped, obviously, having the Axel Springer name behind you to kind of make all parties feel more comfortable with this process?
I don't know. As the Axel Springer name, it helps you only so far.
Yeah.
Then your expertise needs to kick in. Mm. And you, not only your insights, but also your convincing insights, your use cases, as you say.
You need to have some, you need to have some evidence.
Yeah, you need to have some evidence, and you need to, it's not enough to build it on theory, but also the other way around, where you say, we have partners who started here, now they spend, let's say, 40% of their original budget now on a different type of deals, so they switch from private auction over to preferred deals, and they see a CTR on preferred deals of 10%, while private auction 2%. Obviously, that's good for the partner, but it takes, of course, a lot of education to say, to explain people, why does it make sense for you to spend more on this, while still maintaining the other one, and still keep the other one in order to secure your volumes. So there's a lot of, it requires a lot of creativity to explain this, come up with various deals that everybody can understand and everybody wants to understand. Let's put the effort into trying to understand what are the benefits here.
Yeah. And does it require them to think differently as well? Because obviously Update is mobile based. You obviously have a desktop properties, but it's not desktop, mobile web properties, but also you have the app opportunity as well. Do the publishers and advertisers here have to think differently that probably have largely operated in desktop space? Are they approaching mobile with a mobile-specific strategy, or does that take some education as well from you?
I just heard the other day that media agencies in Germany spend around 5% of their budgets on mobile in-app.
This does not surprise me at all.
So definitely there is some challenges.
95% odd worth of education needs to be
new opportunities available for you then.
Exactly. I mean, obviously, in my perspective, it just create a huge opportunity in terms of how we could get more budgets in that sense. But as we grow with more cross-media platforms and products, we also need to get adjusted to that change. Being, what do you get on web that you don't get on mobile in-app, or the other way around? How are your eyeballs attached to a certain advertisement on an in-app compared to a mobile website? What is too intrusive for a user in one case rather than the other one. So yeah, that will only increase the complexity of what we're going to offer. And on top of that, also, we have a new podcast app that just came out, early audio. And that's, again, another element. But what is interesting there is, how could you then offer something where the partner has videos on mobile web, he has some native full screen app placements on the mobile in-app environment, and then audio on the early on our podcast podcast app. So us, as that creates the whole opportunity of this cross product offering, which to me is super interesting.
And I guess especially with the a topic we talk about a lot, and we'll be talking about latest Berlin tomorrow as well, particularly with you, Alex, too, kind of the opportunity for mobile in-app specifically around the identity piece and the future of the third-party cookie looking uncertain. Actually, with the in-app environment, there isn't that challenge. So there's an massive opportunity here for advertisers and publishers to embrace this and try and increase that budget from maybe 5% to maybe
10%.
That
sounds a little bit, yeah.
And this app ad text is also coming along.
Yeah, exactly.
So
yeah.
Also, hopefully, it's going to give, what can I say, advertisers and buyers more confidence in spending mobile in-app. Because to be completely honest, I think there has been a lot of fraud. So it makes sense that they say, okay, I have my safe mobile web desktop traffic over here. This mobile in-app requires a little bit more in order for us to just jump into it. And then again, what does it actually offer me from a buyer perspective?
If they come direct to you as well, obviously it's a very brand safe environment, so they shouldn't have to worry about fraud.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
just helping sell it there for you. Yeah, any advertisers might be listening.
No, I'm completely aware.
Getting a little retainer from giving them a strap line so far.
Just keep them coming. No, that's definitely the case. But it's this whole thing about how do you identify an app, which has been the big problem so far. And I know there's certain apps out there that takes full advantage of this. But now the change is coming, and now as it's going to be more and more difficult to do fraud. So for us, it's probably not going to change a lot, but hopefully you're going to kill some of these fraud environments around the world.
Yeah, and then that's just going to have the knock-on effect of making people feel a little more confident about spending in that type of environment.
Exactly.
And you're going to get a natural probably shift towards people being willing to spend in that environment, as Lindsay said, with the departure of third-party cookie targeting. You know, there's going to be an upside to this for mobile environments to be able to say we can target users in a cookieless environment and this is how we do it. And so you can imagine you're going to get a bit of a natural drift of potential budgets as a result of that.
Yeah, I hope so.
As long as device IDs don't get ruined as well. There's that.
Because that's going to be many the next one here.
Exactly.
Right?
It is. There's many potential challenges along the way, pitfalls along the way. Anything else that you're focusing on an update at the moment that you want to tell us about?
We are going to focus obviously on this cross-media element with more advertising products and a larger sales force. So there's going to be a lot more focus on how can we approach the clients more effectively. Other than that, it's going to be an increasingly more complex mediation stack we're going to face. This whole switch to header bidding. Now both Google, Amazon, and Facebook, by soon, is going to do these, providing these solutions to advertisers. So if that is going to be taking more space from the general mass, or just, I'm going to say, taking the technology to another level, that's going to be super interesting to follow, and for us also to see how can we take advantage of this.
Yeah.
And other than that, see how can we let the technology or our own technology advance this whole data insights, and how can we set up the automated processes in terms of advancing our mediation stack to be, completely optimized. So that's going to be the super interesting part.
It sounds like a full schedule of really exciting things. And also it's just, under the banner of kind of publisher monetization strategies, it's great that you're working on such a diversified offering, because it's critical really for publishers at the moment. So
absolutely.
It's good stuff. Yeah.
And I think soon it's going to be more, or that's going to be one of our next steps, have these more unique strategic partnerships. So it's going to be less with one fits all, and then more try to figure out which is the case adheres specifically to update, and then build those strong ties because that those corporations is
have been successful for you, I suppose, so far, haven't they?
Very successful, but certainly something we could also put more resources into. So we rely less on the big players and try to create corporations with still big players, but not the biggest, and try to see which advantages is that going to bring around.
And surely that's going to be a big advantage to smaller publishers and content providers as well, because quite often they're the ones that will need that.
I believe so, but today a lot of it is focused on gaming apps, and that a lot of these SDK providers can provide specific creatives towards gaming environments. So it's going to be interesting to see how are we as a non-gaming publisher going to face these opportunities. Of course, we're going to have our big environment of different publisher platforms and different medias. But how is that going to be aligned with these unique partnerships?
Yeah, great. Lots to look forward to. I think we've probably run out of time by now. And so, excellent. Thanks very much. That was a really interesting conversation, Alex. Look forward to hearing more about Update in the coming year or two. Thanks very much, Lindsay Rowntree.
You're very welcome.
And shout out to Sound Guy over there. Yeah.
We'll see how it goes when we listen back to it, frankly.
It's going to be good. And that was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.